there's nothing that wasn't created by God. And God does not withhold. God isn't saying, I'm going to give sickness to you and not to you. It doesn't work that way. And you can have it all. All that I have is yours. It's all for you. The final quality or characteristic when I use the word spiritual is cheerfulness. You want to know if you're getting to be more enlightened? How grumpy are you? How much fault finding do you have? How much complaining and bitching and moaning and so on do you do in your life? How often do you look in a mirror and see yourself frowning? How tight are you? How do you see the world and all the people that are in it? Do you wake up in the morning and say, good morning, God? Or do you say, good God, morning? I know that when I am finding myself less cheerful, when I'm coming home and I'm driving into my driveway and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to now hear about which one of them did this and this isn't working right and I got to get this fixed. If I'm thinking like that, I know that I am moving away from spirit. And I catch myself before I even go in the door and say, all of your children are alive. You know, your wife is there. She loves you. Your home is there. It's like I just stop and I purchase bewilderment and I sell my cleverness. Those are the ingredients. This is what I mean when I say spirit. A spiritual solution is these seven ingredients. Surrender, unconditional love, an awareness of the infinite, an empty mind, gratitude and generosity, always knowing that you're connected, and a sense of cheerfulness. And when you have them, and you're able to bring that to the presence of anything that you call a problem, you'll see shortly that they can be nullified. The other two words at the title of this program are problem and solution. Of course, originally says you have no problems, you only think you have. There's also a line in the Course that admits that you do have one problem. And the one problem the Course, A Course in Miracles says you have is your belief that what? The belief that you are separate from God is the only problem that you have. All right? So when I say a problem, it's like you're not willing to turn it over, that is to surrender, to find the infinite within it. You're not willing to do that. And instead, you go from this around in their life believing that this universal presence to which you are connected somehow is disconnected from you. And the only thing that can do that is your ego. And the ego is nothing you'll ever find. You cannot open yourself up, say, I'm checking into a hospital, and I just want an egoectomy, no matter what, all right? Just cut it out of me, get it out of there so I can find. You don't do it that way. A great saint who was a student of Ramana Maharshi, who also had the gift of fish and loaves, came to the West in the beginning of the 20th century. His name was Vivekananda. And when he was asked the question, how do you find what you're speaking about? He said, in the springtime, go out and observe the blossoms on the fruit trees. Such a great lesson. Every spring I do this when I drive through and see the fruit trees, particularly when I'm in the northern part of the country. In the springtime, go out and observe the blossoms on the fruit trees. He said, the blossoms vanish of themselves as the fruit grows. So too will the lower self, the ego, vanish as the divine grows within you. You don't have to defeat this ego. You don't have to beat it down. You don't have to get into a battle with it. You don't have to win anything. You just have to let the divine grow within you. And it will push those lower self blossoms out, if you will, so that the fruit can grow. That's all there is to it. So our problems come down to two things, as far as I'm concerned. One is your belief that you are separate from God. And two is an awareness that all problems are illusions created by the mind. All of them. And I know you're listening. And I know that you can say, well, that's easy for you to say. But you don't know what's going on in my life. You don't know the jerk that I'm married to. I remember listening to Marianne Williamson one time talking about understanding what I'm speaking about here, but saying, dear God, this guy that I'm going with, I know that I am supposed to be able to send love in the face of all of this, but dear God, please, how do you handle an asshole? But you should hear his side. And the fact is that many of you are dealing with people, with events, with struggles, with illnesses, that our very existence, if you will, of course says not real, but exists. Because nothing in the kingdom of God can be real that isn't of love and isn't of God. But it can still exist because our minds can create these illusions. But remember, whatever it is that you are going through in your life, remember what I talked about earlier, that spending 10 years in an orphanage is absolutely crucial to understand self-awareness or self-reliance. That going through the struggles that you go through, even in this moment that you're going through, provides you with the energy to propel yourself to a higher place. And that when you look at them from that perspective, when you begin to see them from that perspective, you begin to become the witness to them, you no longer identify with them. And as soon as you can become unattached to these things that you have called problems, when you detach from them and just notice them, in your mind, you're free. You're free. You just notice. Like St. Francis always called his body in the third person. You sort of look at all of this stuff in the third person and say, oh, poor Wayne. There he goes again. Thinking that his kids have to be the way he was. What a fool. He's so silly. This is a different time. And when he says to them, you want to know what it was like when I was a kid? And they say, no. I don't want to even hear any of that stuff. But that's absolutely exactly what they're supposed to say. Because the fact is that this is a different time. Poor Wayne. He thinks that because his knee hurts, that it's him. And he wants to complain about it. But it's just his knee. It's not who he is. And all of a sudden, your knee doesn't hurt any longer. And all of a sudden, you begin to see your children in a totally different light as doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And you see the absence of the money that you thought that you should have as exactly what it is that you needed in order for you to appreciate this moment and all that you have that is free more fully. You begin to look on it all different. And remember, it's all in your mind. All of it. Everything that you... So these problems are things that we experience in here when you get quiet, when you get peaceful. All you have to do is let go. Just let go. And it's not there in your mind, because surely the presence of God is in this place. And the solution is the third word. What is the solution? Well, preparatory to what is coming next, I want to share with you the 10 observations. Just going to sort of rattle them off, that are the basis for this entire program and this entire presentation here. The solution, the word solution. This is from the introduction to spiritual solution to every problem. Number one, everything in our universe is nothing more than energy. That is, at the very core of its being, everything is vibrating to a certain frequency. Everything is energy, and everything vibrates. Two, slower frequencies are more solid appearing, and this is where our problems show up. Our problems are in the world of the solid and slow, low energies. Three, faster frequencies are less visible, such as light and thought. They're just frequencies, As Einstein said, nothing happens until something moves. Everything is moving. Faster frequencies, such as light and thought. But they're less visible. Four. The fastest frequencies, I am calling spirit. And I've just given you the seven ingredients of spirit. The very fastest frequency that you can encounter is spirit. And those who are living those seven ingredients and are bringing it to the presence of lower frequencies, they instantly nullify them. They said of Jesus, just his presence in the village and nothing more would raise the consciousness of everyone around him. Being in the presence of Mother Mira, when she walked into the room, the energy of the room changed. Being in the presence of Mother Teresa, she walks in the room, and everybody has a feeling of bliss running up and down their spine. And thoughts of hatred are almost impossible in her presence. Five. When the highest and fastest frequencies of spirit are brought to the presence of the lower and slower frequencies, they nullify and dissipate those things we call problems. Six. You have the ability and the power to increase your energy and access the highest and fastest energies for the purposes of eradicating any problems in your life. You can negotiate the presence of higher frequencies, faster spiritual frequencies, at any time in your life. You have the power to do that. And it works. Seven. There are some basic foundations and principles that you will need to understand and practice in order to access spiritual solutions to any problems that you might be experiencing. There are certain principles. Eight, your ultimate choice, once you understand these principles, is whether to align yourself with a high energy field or a low energy field. That's the choice you're always making. You understand the principles? Now you go through your life and you say, all right, I'm aligned over here with spirit, or I'm aligned over here with problems. And all you're doing is aligning yourself with a frequency. Nine. In essence, when you finally come to know and understand the world of spirit on an intimate basis, you will see clearly that all problems are illusions, in that they are concocted by our minds because we have come to believe that we are separate from our source, which I call God, but you can call anything you want. You concoct problems because of your belief that you are separate from God. God is like the ocean, and you are a glass, and you take that glass and you dip it into the ocean, you say, what do I have here? What you have here is a glass of God. It's not as big, it's not as strong, but it's still God. And you take a drop of that water, separate from its source, and you pour it on the floor, and you look at that drop of water, separate from its source, that drop of God, and you say to it, now that it's separate from its source, I would like you to create and sustain life. And you watch that drop of water as you instruct it to create and sustain life, that is to perform miracles, and you watch and see what happens. It will change form, that is, it will become what? A gas, a vapor. And what will it do? It'll return to its source in a different form. I don't know if that sounds familiar, but that's exactly what's happening to you every moment of your life, to your body. Changing form, ultimately returning to its source. But while it is separate from its source, it loses the power of its source. That drop of water, separate from its source, is a symbol for your ego. The part of you that has come to believe you're separate from your source and therefore have lost the power of your source, the power to manifest, the power to heal, the power to create, the power to live a problem-free life. When you reconnect it in its present form, to the ocean, to its source, it now regains the power of the source. It is now the ocean, and it creates and sustains life. Simple little metaphor. And ten, these illusions are nothing more than mistakes in our thinking. And like every error, they dissolve when they're put to face with the truth. Mistakes, errors, erroneous zones. If I had a belief that 2 plus 2 was 7, and I tried to balance my checkbook based upon that piece of information, and I tried to make my calculator work based upon the supposition that 2 plus 2 was 7, I was absolutely convinced that 2 plus 2 was 7, I would find that I couldn't balance my checkbook and my calculator would never work, and I'd always be in a state of confusion. And how do I eradicate that confusion, those problems, that difficulty? If my 2 plus 2 plus 7, the reason that 2 plus 2 is 7 doesn't work is because it has no substance. It's an error. It's a lie. If I bring truth to the presence of that error, I just bring 2 plus 2 is 4 to the presence of that, the supposition that 2 plus 2 is 7, the lie, dissipates. It's gone. It's another metaphor. You bring truth to the presence of an error, and the error dissolves. You don't have to get mad at it. You don't have to be angry at it. You don't have to punish it. You just nullify it by bringing the higher frequency of truth to the presence of the lower frequency. Or as Albert Einstein put it so succinctly, you cannot solve a problem. This afternoon is really what I think of as the central ingredients of understanding a problem-free life. I've been looking through many of the questions that you have asked, and most of them resolve around, to put it bluntly, making me wrong and making yourself right. And that's absolutely, I'm not here to be right, and I'm not here to make anybody wrong. But most people think of problems in terms of horrible things that do happen to people, to innocent people, and are saying things like, it's not so many words, how can you say that there are no problems when these kinds of things happen to people? And they happen, and they do happen. But I would like you to just keep in mind that this universe has a guiding force in it, and that all of us show up into the world on time. And none of us ever questioned. Like, I showed up on May the 10th, 1940. And I've never yet questioned and said, you know, it should have been 1430. Or it should have been 1847. Or it should be 200 years from now. We never question when we show up. Because we show up when we're called. And we also leave when we're called. And one of the hardest things for us to deal with is this whole idea of death and how we die and suffering, and so on. And I'd like to suggest to you that we leave on time. And that a child dying is a tragedy to most of us, of course. And I have 8 children, and I've been blessed that, you know, that they're all healthy and living. And I'm not even saying here that I'm certain that I would be able to handle something terrible happening to them being murdered or raped or anything like that. I'm suggesting that I have a knowing deep within me that we're all here for a purpose, that our lives have a heroic mission, and when that mission is fulfilled and we're called back to God, it's not for us to question with our egos. And that when we say a child is supposed to be born and be healthy and die in their sleep in their 100th year, that's just our egos talking. But then, in fact, some children come in for only a week, and some come in for 4 months, and some come in for 6 years, have lessons to teach, and leave. And the tragedy is that we interpret all of that through the eyes of it shouldn't happen. Hunger and starvation are part of the perfection of the universe. But so is your desire to end it. And that's where you want to place your attention and your energy. Not on what is wrong, but on what it is that you feel in your heart you can do to bring us all closer to God. And the grieving process that some of you refer to in your questions is not necessarily the self-actualized way that you handle tragedies in our lives. I remember a book by Ernest Hemingway called The Islands in the Stream. Then this man finds out that his son has just been killed in the war overseas in Europe. And that night he's at a party and he's dancing. And someone said to him, "How could you possibly be here when you found out what happened to your son this afternoon?" And his answer in that novel was, "Sooner or later, I know I'm going to have to get over this or it will destroy me. I just picked sooner." And that sounds cruel to some of us who believe that we have to spend a long time suffering. But I remember when Nisargadatta said to a woman who complained to her about her cancer, she said, "I suffer so." And he said, "You do not suffer. Only the person you imagine yourself to be suffers." And when she responded, "You can't tell me that you don't suffer," she wanted to make him wrong. And she started pointing out all the things that were wrong in India, and the war with Pakistan, and all of the pestilence, and all of the poverty, and all of the horrible things, and the starvation, and so on. And he looked at her and said straight away, and I'll never forget this, he said, "Ma'am, in my world, nothing ever goes wrong." That's not something I'm asking you to just embrace enthusiastically. I know that you've been raised in a certain way, as I have, and I ache when I see children hurt, when I see people maimed. And I'm suggesting to you that there is another way to even begin to look at all of this from the perspective of yourself as an infinite soul. And the problem then no longer becomes something that you are living with in agony and pain and suffering and creating all of the diseases of your life, but it becomes a clarion call to bring the world closer to God. And like I said about my father, maybe he signed up to be a jerk, to be a thief, to be a drunk, in order to teach me how to forgive it. I'm not saying it's easy, but as Maslow said, those are the flaws of self-actualizing people. In writing A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem, I had the most joyous, wonderful time for about a month of immersing myself into a book written somewhere between 2300 and 1800 years ago. Somewhere between the 2nd century AD and the 3rd century before Christ. We're not sure when. It was written by a great teacher who is the only person I didn't have a photograph or a drawing of in writing Wisdom of the Aces. Most of the research I did on this particular individual or series of individuals was very obscure about who he or she was, when they lived. They could only pinpoint it to within 500 years. And yet these great teachings have survived for several thousand years now. And out of these teachings, the basic principles for a spiritual solution to every problem evolved for me. There were many. The book is called How to Know God. It's the same title that Deepak Chopra used for his latest book, and he borrowed it from Patanjali, which is perfectly legal and right and in order, because titles are never copyrighted and can't be. And I remember being at his home and talking to him about the title of his book and having read it and given him some feedback on it. And finally, we all just decided that why not call it How to Know God? Now, it's not called How to Know About God. It's not called How to Believe in God. It's called How to Know God. And How to Know God means making conscious contact with God. It's the only way you can know anything. How do you know how to ride a bicycle? Because you've been on one. Not because somebody else has given you their testimony. not because you've watched other people do it or you've listened to other people telling you that it's possible. Those are all approaching knowing. Knowing God means, or knowing bicycle riding, or knowing swimming means getting in the water, getting on the bike, slipping around, getting your head wet, perhaps swallowing some water, falling a few times, and eventually having that knowing. And even though many of you haven't been on a bicycle for 20 years or more, if I put one in here and you were on one when you were five, you would get on it with a knowing and you would ride off. And if you haven't been on one, you would have questions about whether it's possible, and I don't know, that little seat, and look at the size of my seat, and those little tiny tires, and you would have all kinds of questions until you have the knowing. And the same thing is true of how to know God. And I have participated in a book. I call this a bathroom book. I love this. I brought some here with me today. It's called The Experience of God. And I was a contributor, along with Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, Louise Hay, Ram Dass, Bernie Siegel, Scott Peck, Joan Borzenko, and many others. And I call this a bathroom book. And I suggest that you take the book and you put it into your bathroom and place it on the stool in your bathroom. Well, don't place it on the stool. That's probably not the right choice of words. Place it on the little chair that sits in there. And it's a metaphor for all that we're talking about here. That is, you replace what is leaving with a higher frequency, with the Spirit of God. And all of us were asked to explain our experience of God, what it means to know God. And I just love this, and I think it's a wonderful, wonderful gift to give. Who does this resonate with? Does anyone feel like they would like this lady right here? Would you like to have a copy? You're very welcome. God bless you. The Experience of God. It's published by Hay House. Coming to know God, japa meditation is one of ways to come to know God. There are many others. In reading the aphorisms of Patanjali, he was talking, now you have to remember, we're talking about before the Middle Ages, which were called the Dark Ages. We're talking about a time when there was no such thing as running water, when the church and the power of the early crusades and things like this were the dominant force on the planet. There was an awful lot of talk about different kinds of gods, a god for the sun, a god for the moon, a god for the water, a god. And many of the conveniences and things that we just sort of take for granted in our daily life were not a part of what the world was like several thousand years ago. And here was Patanjali writing about the ability to be able to do absolutely miraculous things, the ability to be able to be in more than one place at the same time, the ability to be able to be in the presence of another human being and raise your energy to such a level that you could literally, by your presence alone, just heal that person. The ability to be able to transcend things like diseases. The ability to be able to have the gift of fish and loaves. To just live at such a level of consciousness that anything you placed your attention on instantaneously, you had the capacity and the power to be able to make that realization for you, even before Christ was born and talked about these things, these miracles. The ability to levitate, to fly, to breathe underwater. Things that we think, these are impossibilities. Patanjali was writing about, but not only was he writing about them, he was giving very specific instructions on how to go about achieving this level of consciousness in what he called sutras. And when you begin to practice these particular sutras, which are aphorisms, the repetition of which, if you say you start with these in 40 days, say there are 40 sutras, and there are more. There are some 400. But if I were to repeat the first sutra on the first day, and I would just repeat that and repeat that over and over again endlessly in my mind, and then the second day, on this 40-day plan, I would repeat the first sutra, and then I would repeat the second sutra over and over and over again as a meditation, as a mantra. And then on the third day, I would repeat the first sutra and the second sutra, and then I would repeat endlessly over and over again for an hour or so this third sutra. You would do this for 40 days and 40 nights. And I began to practice these. This was years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. It happened to me in my office. I was on about the 19th or 20th day of repeating these sutras. I was very committed to it, and it was getting to be a point where I literally didn't feel like I was a part of my body anymore. I felt like I could just leave it almost at will. And miraculous kinds of things began to happen in tennis matches. Tennis balls would stop in midair when I would have my attention so focused on that ball, and I would find myself running toward it and seeing it sitting there as if it were just holding there waiting for me to get to it. And people would be watching me play, and I remember one time doing this, and I went for a ball, and everybody walked away and said, well, that point is over and that game is over. And I just kept going and going and going, and the ball, and I got over and I just hit the ball back and got it into the other court and won the point. And everyone looked around who had walked away and said, well, you couldn't have got to the ball. It must have bounced twice. And they said, what happened? What did you do? I said, I was so intense, the concentration, the energy from my eyes and from my attention, from my body, was in such that it seemed to me to just hang there. These kinds of things were happening to me. I remember falling one time and feeling myself falling. It was at a place where all of the children were in one of the springs out on Maui. And I was on top of this, and I was going to jump anyway, but then I started to fall. And I felt myself tumbling, but it was as if I went from falling very, very fast at the speed of gravity, 32 feet per second per second. Instead, I was going at 1 foot per hour. That's what it seemed like. And I just was outside of my body, literally watching my body fall. And people have reported experiences like this of getting, like being on a gurney or whatever and falling off and going so slow that they literally were able to stop themselves from being hurt, which is those kinds of things began to happen as I was doing these sutras. And one day I was in my office, and I don't remember what day it was or what sutra I was on from the yogic aphorisms of Patanjali, which is not exactly best-selling literature. But for me, it's glorious to read. And it's the kind of book, How to Know God, the original version of How to Know God, you can only read about a paragraph a day. And you have to really study everything that's in it in great depth. And I was doing these sutras, and I was on the 19th one, and I was repeating it, and I was in my office, and I was in this state. And all of a sudden, I began to feel my body lifting off of the ground. And then it seemed to just settle back down again. And I really loved that. It was just so glorious. I mean, I dream this stuff all the time. I don't know how many of you have flying dreams, but I'm always dreaming of flying. It happens to me, it seems like, 2 or 3 times a week. And everybody down there on the ground just keeps saying, how do you do it? How do you do it? And I just say, you just have to take yourself lightly. Just take yourself lightly. It's so simple. And no one on the ground can figure out what's going on. How come I'm able to do that? And it's the most glorious, peaceful. But to be able to do it when you're not dreaming, because, you know, you don't know whether you're dreaming or not. As Lao Tzu said, I went to sleep and I dreamt that I was a butterfly. And then I awoke. And now I don't know. Am I a man who dreamt he was a butterfly? Or am I a butterfly dreaming he's a man? How could you know? At any rate, I then felt my body go up again and just sort of get very light and levitate for a second or two, and time has no bearing on this, so I don't know whether I'm talking a second or a minute. I just don't know. And then I would settle back down again. And then I got up and I stayed there. At least I seemed like I was there. I was floating. And then I had this thought. And the thought was, I could do this on the Tonight Show. I know that's weird, but that was what? What is that? Ego. And the minute that I had that thought, I went down on my rear end, and I've never had the experience since. It's never come back. Because the moment that you involve your self-importance and your ego, and it's why a Sai Baba doesn't come and appear with Jay Leno to manifest for Buddha, because they won't enter a field of consciousness in which doubt is present. Because as we learn in quantum physics, a very simple principle, the observer affects what they observe. And the energy field that you bring to what you are observing literally impacts that which is being observed. And they will not allow themselves to be in such energy fields. And I could understand it completely. That it isn't about proving anything, about winning. It isn't about me. It isn't about being more holy than somebody else. That's just all ego. And so what I want to share with you in these remaining moments here is five of these aphorisms. Now, I came across something from How to Know God that I had it copied, I had it laminated, and I carried it with me wherever I went for years, and I still keep it in my note bag. And I put it in Wisdom of the Ages, and I wrote an essay about it, and it was from Patanjali. And it was, for me, for years, and still is, one of the most significant pieces of writing in terms of its impact on creating a spiritual solution to problems that I've ever heard. It goes like this. He said, when you are inspired, and inspired, of course, means what? In spirit, as opposed to being in form. When you're in form, what do you get? Informed or information. When you're in spirit, you get inspiration. And there's no shortage of information. This has been called the information age. I'm about trying to move us into the inspiration age because it's a deficit of spirit that creates all of these illusions that we call problems in our world, collectively and individually. And he put it this way. He said, when you are inspired by some great purpose, some extraordinary project, all of your thoughts break their bonds. Your mind transcends limitations. Your consciousness expands in every direction. And you find yourself in a new and a great and a wonderful world. And then the part that always gets to me, he said, dormant forces, faculties, and talents come alive. Dormant forces, that is, forces that you thought were dead, come alive. And you discover yourself to be a greater person by far than you ever dreamed yourself to be. All you have to do is become inspired. That is, move into spirit, into the higher frequencies. And when you go there and are inspired, I want to tell you, I have written in the state of inspiration that Patanjali describes for 24 straight hours without getting hungry or sleepy. When you're in that state of inspiration, you don't ever think about money. And you don't ever think about what ails you. I've had a blister on my foot from running in some new shoes yesterday for 5 miles, those shoes that I had on last night. And I had a blister in there. And the blister was bothering me when I came here this morning. But for the past 3 hours that I have been speaking, I haven't even noticed the blister. Because when you're inspired, things like blisters just don't make any difference in your life. They're just not there. Now that I'm thinking about it, it's starting to bother me again. I've had a problem with my knee and running and all that, and it gets swelled up and so on. But for 3 hours of standing here on my leg, I don't feel any sense of discomfort whatsoever. Because when you're inspired, dormant forces come alive and collaborate with you to create whatever it is that you need to be created. And when you're in a state of inspiration, for me, when I'm writing, and if I get stuck on something and I have all of this great literature surrounding me, I just get up and I walk around and I sit down on the couch and I close my eyes and then I just get up and I go get a glass of water and I'll pick up something that I'm directed to and I'll open it and it's exactly, I mean, it just happens so frequently that it used to like freak me out. Now I just say, of course. And I don't have anybody there because it's the middle of the night. But I really just want to say, look at how magnificent this is. All you have to do is stay in spirit, stay inspired, and whatever you need is going to be provided. And if it isn't there in the room, then go to your mailbox. Or turn on your answering machine. Or walk into a bookstore, and whatever it is that you need, you'll be drawn to it. Or the phone will ring. I wrote about it in Wisdom of the Ages, when the only person who knew my phone number the whole time that I was working on this was Deepak Chopra and my wife. I say my wife and my other wife, Deepak. And at the moment that I was trying to figure something out, he telephoned me there at this place that nobody knew the number. And I told him all of that, and he said, well, that's why I called. I got your message in the field. He likes to take credit for all of this stuff. And I wrote about exactly that, because I want you to know that when you become inspired, these dormant forces come alive. And here are the aphorisms. There are five of them that I picked as the most significant ones for you to grasp as we move into these frequencies of higher awareness called spiritual consciousness, and how you can identify them and see how they work in your life, which are coming up. By the way, Rumi wrote these words about who can do this. He said, come. Come, whoever you are. Wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even if you have broken your vows 100 times, 1,000 times, come, come, come again and again. Isn't that beautiful? That whole idea that it's like, just because you've had failures and it hasn't worked or you've broken your... Just keep... This is not a caravan of despair. Where there is despair, St. Francis said, what? Let me bring hope. Hope. So here are the five aphorisms, very quickly. And I'm not going to go into a great detail on them now because they will become self-explanatory this afternoon. The first is called, the central act of ignorance is false identification. The central act of ignorance is called false identification. What does Patanjali mean by false identification? And what does he mean by ignorance? Ignorance is not to be assumed to mean that you are uninformed. It means that you are identifying yourself as a human being with your body and your possessions and this material world. And the central act of that ignorance is the identification falsely with this world of the changing. But beyond the world of the changing is the changeless world. And once you start to identify yourself there and know that this is who you are, know it. Like you're listening right now and you're watching, and the energy that is coming into you is coming through your eyes and ears and senses. And it is only your eyes and your ears and your senses that take this energy and twist it into something called evil or problems. It comes into your eyes, these energies, and into your ears, if it could be examined just before it hits your eyes. And just before it reaches your ears, and we could examine it very carefully, you would find that the scientists would say, no, there's no problems in that energy. There's no evil in that energy. Nope, it's just energy. It's just a frequency. It's vibrating at a certain speed. But as soon as it hits your senses and you begin to interpret it, problems begin to show up in your life. But the energy itself contains no problems. It's just energy. And the observation from Rumi that I made for this first aphorism of Patanjali is this. The illumined soul, this is from the Bhagavad Gita, The illumined soul thinks always, I am doing nothing. No matter what he sees or hears or touches or smells or eats, this he knows always. I am not seeing, I am not hearing. It is the senses that see and hear and touch the things of the senses. I am doing nothing. My senses are doing all of that. That's proper identification according to Patanjali. That's the first aphorism. The second aphorism sounds like this. The mind of the truly illumined, said Patanjali, is calm. because the peace of God within all things is known, even within the appearance of misery and disease. Even within the appearance of misery and disease, the mind of the truly illumined is always calm. And this is a reference that Patanjali made that really struck me. He said, God cannot express God's self in you when you are not at peace. If you're not at peace, at any moment in your life, you have sent God out of your life. And God can't express God's self in you. And the mind of the truly illumined understands that the peace of God is in all things. And of course, in miracles, there's this wonderful line. Again, I have this on my office where I look at it every day. There is a way of living in the world, says the Course, that is not here. Although it seems to be. You do not change appearance, though you smile more frequently. Your forehead is serene, your eyes are quiet, and the ones who walk the world as you do recognize their own. Yet those who have not yet perceived the way will recognize you also and believe that you are like them as you were before. That gives me goose flesh. Every time I read it, and I've read it 1,000 times at least, there's a way of living in the world that is not here, although it seems to be. This is who Jesus was. You are in this world, but what? You are not of this world. That is not who you are. You are not of this world, even though you're in it. So you're filling out the forms. You send in your money to the IRS, and you stop at the red lights, and you obey the laws, and you follow the rules, that is, most of them, which seem to make sense, and the ones that don't, you're able to ignore, which you have to, otherwise we'll never have any growth. Otherwise, you know, when my mother was born, my own mother was born, and she's alive today, women couldn't vote in this country. That was the law. Somebody had to say, we have to disregard this, the laws that don't make sense. Somebody has to do that. Somebody has to do that. But you're in the world, and so you're what my friend Stuart Wilde calls a fringe dweller. You sort of dwell on the fringe. But you know that there's a deeper and a richer experience of life, and it's available to you, and you're going to have it. So that's the second aphorism. The peace of God is in everything, even what it appears not to be. The third aphorism is quite simple, and it's one that's most troubling to many people in the West. Patanjali said, sin is non-existent. Sin is non-existent. There are only obstacles to one's ultimate union with God. You do not sin. When you behave toward another person in a harmful way, when you steal from another person, when you violate any of the commandments or whatever, you have not sinned. You have created an obstacle to your union with God. And it is in the recognition that I now have this obstacle and I've got to deal with this obstacle and it's present there, and I will eliminate that obstacle from my life. Is another way. You see, the reason we don't want to put sin in there, according to Patanjali, is because it creates shame and guilt. Shame computes the absolute lowest in whether you're going to be strong or weak in your life. Shame is the lowest frequency emotion that is possible. It only computes at 25 on a scale of 1 to 1,000. And here's a parable from the New Testament, Jesus and the blind man. As he went along, he saw a blind man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus responded, neither this man nor his parents sinned, But this happens so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. There's no sin in there. And it's a very powerful thing, and it's something that a lot of organized religions have taught. But you know, one of the observations that Jung made about organized religion was, he said that the central purpose of organized religion seems to be to prevent people from having a direct experience of God. That is, we'll do that for you. You give us your indulgences. You give us your... and we'll do, but we don't want you to have direct experience of God. And this is Jung's observation. The fourth aphorism that leads us into a spiritual solution to every problem sounds like this. And these last two are the ones that I absolutely resonate to and love the most. The person who is steadfast in his abstention from falsehood has the power to obtain for himself and others the fruits of good deeds without having to perform the deeds themselves. Now that sounds complicated. I'm going to give it to you again. The person who is steadfast in abstaining from falsehood has the power to obtain for himself and others the fruits of good deeds without having to perform the deeds themselves. Steadfast in abstaining from means that you never waver and you never have thoughts of falsehood, that is, identifying yourself as a material being rather than a spiritual being. And when you become steadfast in that, when you say to someone, God blesses you, they are blessed by your presence when you have that kind of consciousness. And you present yourself to someone and you are absolutely steadfast in abstention from falsehood. And in the presence of such a person, healing takes place. And blessing takes place. And that's all you have to do to become someone who performs these spiritual miracles. And the fifth aphorism, my favorite of all, says, when a person is steadfast in his abstention from harming others, then all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in his or her presence. Let me give it to you again. When a person becomes steadfast in their abstention from thoughts of harming others, all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in their presence, pain, hatred. That was St. Francis. It wasn't that he most of the time didn't have thoughts of anger and hatred toward other people. He never had them. When Nisargadatta was asked, what's the difference between saints and the rest of us? Is it that they have unconditional love and we don't in them? He said, no. You have unconditional love in you, and so do the saints. He said, the only difference between you and the saints is that they have nothing else inside of them to give away. So when you become steadfast in your abstention from ever having a thought of harm directing at other people, and that's how you walk through the world, butterflies will land on your shoulder. Birds will not be afraid of you. Little dogs or even vicious dogs will become domesticated by being in your presence. All living creatures, babies, will goo-goo and come to you. You know people like this, don't you? There are some people, particularly children, but there are some people who in their presence, because they never have a thought that is directed of anger or judgment or hatred toward another, no one feels enmity in their presence. It's absolutely astonishing. And if you read Costanzakis' St. Francis, you'll see that that was his life from the 24th of September, a Sunday, in the year 1206. When he had his revelation, when he was spoken to, and gave up all of his worldly possessions. And for the next 20 years of his life, until he was 45 when he died, he ceased to have thoughts of harm directed at anyone, particularly his father, who rejected him, and his mother who was in deep pain, and all of the people, including the sultans, when he went to the Crusades and tried to convince the Christians not to murder the Muslims, and when he went to Pope Innocent III and asked for his blessing in confirming his order, and was willing to walk through the fire to prove his connection to God if the Pope would follow him into the fire. I will walk in there and not be burned. And St. Francis was able to do those things. And the Pope got very nervous. I want to just close out this session with a letter that was written to me by a woman in Oregon. Her name is Michelle Moore, and she has given me permission to use this letter. And it's about being steadfast and having a knowing. Dear Wayne, I don't even know how to begin this letter. I wrote to you back in 1996 because my son was missing. He had gotten into the world of drugs and had slipped away. At the time I wrote to you, I was distraught and panicked. I also was trying to start an organization to help others find their children turned of age who had fallen prey to drug addiction. You very kindly wrote me back, and your first sentence stated, "You will be directed to Jeff. Know this beyond anything resembling doubt." I kept that letter with me at all times. I ran those words over and over in my mind while holding the vision of Jeff and I embracing when I found him. Everyone I spoke with told me Jeff probably wouldn't want to see me, or he would be mad at me, or he would run from me. I never believed that. I knew that when we saw each other face to face, we would talk and come to an understanding, if nothing else. Now for the good news. I did indeed find Jeff. When we saw each other face to face, the vision that I had held became a reality. He hugged me, told me he loved me, spoke to me of his pain, his longing to live a different life, then walked with me out of the drug world. We are now starting an agency together called Third Option to help other parents reconnect with their children. I wrote an article in the My Turn column of Newsweek that ran in the August 18th, 1997 edition. From that article, we were asked to appear on Primetime Live, Good Morning America, CNBC, and many other shows. From that, we have just signed a contract to have our story made into a movie. Also, I have written a book that I hope will be published called To Jeff, Love Mom. When the proceeds come from these things, we will have the money to get our organization up and running in the form that we envision. Already, we have helped a couple of parents locate their children and have counseled a dozen more. Jeff just finished up a case in San Francisco. I am now starting to contact federal legislators to see what can be done to give parents of children turned of age more rights when they become lost to them in the world of addiction. I just wanted to write to give you some good news and to thank you for that simple phrase that you wrote to me in your letter. We are all light for one another. And for those few words about being directed to Jeff illuminated my path more than once when the fear and devastation of being without my son would overwhelm me. Thank you so very much. Well, that's about it. Just a huge hug from me with much gratitude from my heart. Oh, by the way, you may see a dramatic rise in the sale of your book, Real Magic. It is my favorite, and I tell every parent I talk to get the book. Love, warmest personal regards, Michelle Moore. Do you see? It's just a simple letter. I get thousands of letters a month, and I try to answer them all. But when I do, I try to write from a position that Patanjali taught me 2,000 years ago. Be steadfast in your abstention from thoughts of falsehood, of fear, that things won't work out. Be steadfast. And what you'll do is set into motion these dormant forces which will collaborate with you because you're in spirit rather than in form. What I'd like to spend this session on is I went through a couple of quotes. One was from Valerie Hunt's book, The Infinite Mind, which is the display quote for the sixth chapter of Spiritual Solution. She said, "But I do not believe that man can perceive his godlike qualities until his field reaches higher and higher vibrations and attains a greater degree of coherency. No matter how hard we may try to receive spiritual guidance, we cannot until our fields are attuned to that vibrational system called God." Let me share that with you again. "But I do not believe that man can perceive his godlike qualities until his field reaches higher and higher vibrations and attains a greater degree of coherency." So that you can sit there in anger and in fear and in shame and all of the reactions in your life that compute to make you weak, and that will make sense shortly. And you can never come to know God according to the mind field theory that Dr. Hunt espouses and talks about, and according to a spiritual solution to every problem. Because when you're not at peace, you have sent your body into a vibrational field of energy in which you have allowed your mind to create the error or the illusion that you and God are no longer connected. And that begins to take over. And as hard as you may try, and no matter what you may do, until you can raise the frequency at which you vibrate, until you can raise the energy level at which you experience life and move out of the lower and slower frequencies and into the higher frequencies, you will not be able to access and negotiate the presence of a spiritual solution to your problems. That's the first quote. The second one comes from a book that I guess I'll just share with you now. It's a book that is very difficult to get a hold of, and how I got a hold of it is a great coincidence. One of those things that fits together perfectly. I was giving a talk in a little town in Pennsylvania, and someone put a note on my table, like all of the things that I have up here on the stage, and asked if I had ever read a book called Power Versus Force by David Hawkins, a medical doctor. I had never heard of it. And the note said that in this book he did a lifelong study of energy and frequencies and how they relate to various emotional states, and gave a numerical way of calibrating through the measurement of frequencies what emotional state you were in. And it's a 29-year study. Well, I called my friend at Hay House, my expert on the internet and finding obscure things, because I looked it up in books and print and it wasn't there. Reed Tracy, who's the president of Hay House, who's here today, said, "I'll order it for you. It'll take 6 weeks to get there." And that was maybe 3 months ago. Never showed up. Hasn't arrived yet. And the order went in. And I was in a one of those real large Borders bookstores where they have every book that was ever printed, and you can drink coffee while you're finding them, and you can meet your next wife or husband, and and have somebody speaking to you over here, and read a magazine on hot rods over here, and go to the children's section, and it goes for about six blocks, but try to find somebody in the store. Well, that's a different story altogether. At any rate, I was just in there, and I thought, I'll look in the psychology section and see if such a book exists. And I looked through all of the different departments, and it wasn't there. And then suddenly, because I had seen a picture of it on the Amazon.com on the internet, and I saw it in the wrong section, in the wrong place, but there it was. And it was wrapped up in cellophane. And I grabbed it, Power Versus Force, by David Hawkins, who lives in Sedona, Arizona, and is a medical doctor. And I have singularly decided to make this man famous, whether he likes it or not, because his book, which I have here in front of me, The Hidden Determinants of Human Behavior, is the result of a 29-year study that began in 1965, I believe, and ended in 1994. And I'll be quoting some from this and sharing some of the things in here. But basically, he asserts that there is power, and then there is force. And when you attempt to use force, you lower your frequency. And when you are empowered, you are operating at a higher frequency. And he said, I'll give you one example. For example, in athletics, and he measured all up and down the spectrum of every aspect of human behavior. Athletics just happened to be one. Entertainment is another. Business is another. He measured and looked at how people calibrate ancient people, such as Buddha and Rumi, and contemporary people, and it's an exhaustive, incredible study. And I just was fascinated with this book. And it's written in beautiful language. He's a medical doctor and a PhD. But he self-published this book, and I had Hay House call and say, get this book. It's self-published. I'd like to see it in all the bookstores. I'm going to talk about it at all my talks. And Reed called him, and he likes being a publisher. He's a psychiatrist in practice in Sedona and doesn't want it published. But that's okay, because he'll have to. Because I just ordered 1,000 copies from him through Hay House, and I'll be taking them to my talks and distributing them, and eventually it'll get more than he wants to handle. Because I think the world needs to see the message of this. And in athletic performance, for example, he said that when a person is performing in an athletic contest, whether it's a tennis match or a road race or a baseball game or a football or weightlifting or diving or anything that you can think of when you're out there athletically competing, that if your energy or your attention is on force, that is on being able to defeat your opponent, you will always calibrate weaker. It will make you weaker. When your emphasis is on defeating someone else or trying to overcome them, and they can measure what thoughts you have, and when they're on that, you will become weaker and you will perform at a lower level. But when you put your energy and your attention on performing at the most empowering level that you are capable of performing at, and using your God-given abilities and talents to just allow yourself to go out there and connect at the spiritual level and perform, you will always perform at a higher level, and you will calibrate strong rather than weak. And I found an interesting dilemma when the Olympics of a while back took place. And there was this, in the news media, all of this hype about who was the world's fastest human being. You remember? And in the 100 meters, there was a man named Maurice Green. And he had run the fastest 100-meter race. And then there was a man named Michael Johnson, who had run the fastest 400-meter race. And both of them were world setters, world record holders in their respective races. But the race between the 100 meters and the 400 meters is what? 200 meters, all right? An eighth of a mile. Maurice and Michael go on television. And they're like Muhammad Ali was with George Foreman a few generations back. I'm the greatest. No, I'm the greatest. I'm going to beat, I'm faster than, I'm the world's fastest. Nope, I'm the world's fastest human. And there was all of this stuff going on between the two in which animosity, and whether it was feigned or not, became the trademark of this particular race. And they both got to the final heats in the Olympic trials to decide who was going to run the 200 meters to represent the United States. And both of them are in there, they're next to each other, they're lined up, and they're ready to go. And all the cameras in the world are on this race. Who's the world's fastest at 200 meters? They're finally going to race each other. They have been avoiding each other. And what happened in the 200 meters? Both of them, the two finest runners in the world, and their respective distances, pulled up lame in that finals, and neither one of them qualified to run the Olympics. And it was bearing out exactly what Dr. Hawkins talked about in Power versus Force. Now, in here, he has presented a map. Well, let me give you his quote first. He said in the introduction to his book on page 12, "The individual human mind is like a computer terminal connected to a giant database. The database is human consciousness itself." You get that picture? "Of which our own consciousness is merely an individual expression." So you're connected to this database through the individual expression of your own human consciousness to something called human consciousness. "But with its roots in the common consciousness of all mankind. This database is the realm of genius." The database of human consciousness is the realm of genius. It's power, not force. "Because to be human is to participate in the database. You have no choice in this. You showed up as human. And therefore, you are connected to this database called human consciousness, like it or not. Everyone, by virtue of his birth, has access to genius. Everyone. No exceptions. That's all of you. That's all of you listening. That's all of you here in this room. That it just becomes a question of how am I going to connect and at what frequencies am I going to connect to it? But human consciousness is the frequency of genius. The highest frequencies are what human consciousness is. And you can plug in anywhere you want, at any level that you want. I want to show you this map of human consciousness. Map of human consciousness goes from a frequency that he has created called 1 to 1,000. And the lower the frequency, that is, the slower the vibration, the more it will keep you weak. And anything below 200, by his formulation, after 29 years of study, anything that calculates or vibrates or calibrates lower than 200 will weaken you. It will take away your strength. And anything above 200, up to as high as 1,000, will empower you. So below 200 is force, above it is empowerment. The lowest level in this map of consciousness is called shame. That when you are experiencing a shameful thought, you will weaken yourself. The next up is guilt. The next up is apathy. All of these will weaken you, and we're going to demonstrate it shortly. The next is grief. Grief itself, even though there's a lot of people making a strong case for it, to grieve is to weaken yourself. Fear, which has as its emotional counterpart anxiety. Craving, or ultimate desire. Anger and pride, which is scorn and hate, are all going to weaken you. Now, the ones that will strengthen you, starting from the lowest ones that will strengthen you, that calibrate at 250 and above, are neutrality, which has an emotional correlate of trust, and then willingness, that calibrates at 310, and that's optimism, and then acceptance, which is forgiveness in the emotional realm, is 350. Reason and understanding calibrate at 400. Love and reverence at 500. Joy at 540 and serenity. And finally, peace at 600 is the highest that most of us will ever reach. Peace and bliss being will always empower you. Now, I'm just talking about thoughts here, just thoughts of peace and bliss. Whereas the highest one, enlightenment, which is the emotion of ineffability, calibrates between 700 and 1,000. The highest person on the planet when he did this study was Mother Teresa at 700. The highest person ever calibrated was Jesus and Buddha and people of that, in which they went through historical records and were able to calibrate them. And, of course, the highest at 1,000 is called God consciousness. Okay? So that's what he calls a map of consciousness. All right? And it's just, it's an interesting formulation. The way it's written is beautifully done. And just go try to find it and get a copy of it somewhere and make him get this book out there. All right? It's really worth reading. What I'd like to do at this time is just a very brief demonstration. And then I want to move into these frequencies and how they work in our lives. If I could have... is there anybody here who's in a second marriage? Second marriage? Okay. Second, third, even better. Okay. Would you mind volunteering? Okay. All right, Allison, we're going to do a little kinesthesiology thing here. All right? It's a very simple thing. And I want you to cooperate totally. We have made no agreements before. You haven't... All right. Okay, I am going to put one hand here, and I'd like you to hold your arm out, your right arm, as hard as you can, and I'd like you to resist me as much as possible. I'm going to use two fingers and put it like this, make a fist, okay, and then when I push down with these two fingers, I want you to resist me as strong as you can, okay, so that you feel how much pressure and you feel how strong you are, that I really can't budge your arm at this using this. Now, I could if I really grabbed it, but I'm just using two fingers. And I'm pushing down here as hard as I can, and she's able to resist. Okay, what I'd like you to do first is to just give me your full name.
Alice.
Alice, would you hold your arm up? All right, what is your name?
Alice.
Is that the truth?
It's my name this week.
I'll do the comedy here if you don't mind, huh? All right, your name is Allison, and is that the truth?
Yes.
Okay, now you hold that thought in. Okay, you're telling the truth, and you can see that I cannot budge her arm down with my two fingers. Okay, now what I'd like you to do this time is I'd like you to make up a name when I ask you. But when I ask you if it's the truth, I'd like you to lie to me. Okay, I'd like you to say, yes, it is the truth, even though it's a lie. Okay, now hold your arm out. Okay, what is your name?
Allison Jones.
Okay, your name is Allison Jones?
Yes.
Is that the truth?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I'd like you to think of your first marriage. Yeah. See, for those of you listening, she just had a collapse, huh? All right. And I'd like you to think of the moment when you had a realization that this marriage was over and that you could no longer stay in it, whatever that moment was, the moment of disappointment, that moment, whatever it is that you felt, okay, the hurt that you felt when you knew this marriage was not going to be a success, okay? Hold your arm up. All right. I'd like you to just think of that moment, okay? Ready? And I want you to resist me, okay? Okay. Okay. Now I'd like you to think of your present marriage. Are you married now?
Yes.
Okay. And when you first met your husband and you realized this was someone you loved very much and when you felt perhaps most loved in your life by this man, okay? Can you think of that moment? Okay. Now I'd like you to resist me as hard as you can, okay? Okay. I can't push around now. Now I'd like you to think of a moment in your life when you felt shame. You don't have to share what it was. Just a moment of shame, whatever it was. Can you think of that moment? Okay. All right. All right. What are you thinking? You're thinking a moment of, you're thinking of that shame? All right. Now I want you to resist. Now come on, resist. Okay? Okay. Now I'd like you to think for a moment of a moment when you felt bliss. Probably as blissful as you've ever felt in your life. Okay? Right, now I'd like you to... Okay, now I want you to really resist me now, okay? Ready? I can't push your arm now. If you can go back in your life at any time, Allison, and think of a moment when you experienced fear, when you were afraid, perhaps, I won't tell you, I won't give you any examples, just a moment of fear. Can you think of a moment of fear? All right. Now, come on, I want you to really resist me this time, all right? All right, fear. Ready? Okay. Now, I'd like you to go back in your life and think of a moment when you felt closest to God. All right, or spirit, whatever that might mean to you, okay? Your connection, like when you knew that God and you were one. Can you hold, right, hold your arm up? Okay, now resist as strong as you can. Come on, be strong. I can't push your arm down. Okay, now hold on one moment. I have two envelopes here. I feel like Johnny Carson here. I'd like you to just pick one. You've never seen these envelopes before. Okay, just take one of these envelopes. Either one, doesn't make any difference. All right, just set that one down then. I'd like you to take that envelope, and with this hand, I'd like you to push it into your solar plexus, okay? Like it's going to become a part of your heart, all right? Now, you have no idea what's in it, do you? Okay. Okay, hold your arm out. I don't even know which envelope you've picked, all right? Now, I want you to resist as hard as you can. Now, come on. Okay, you've got to cooperate. Ready? Okay, whatever that is making you weaker, okay? Now, let's take this envelope. Would you hand me this envelope? Okay, now you're taking the second envelope, and you're holding that, the second one that you picked. And I want you to hold this against your solar plex, and I want you to resist as strong as you can. Okay, ready? Resist. Okay, I can't push her arm down. Okay, thank you, Allison. All right. You want to hold that envelope up to the light, and just, I don't want to open it, because I just, can you see what it is? Well, I'll tell you what's in the envelope. No. Sweet and low. The first envelope in which she was weakened by pushing it into her solar plexus without even knowing what it was, with no awareness of her mind, is something called aspartame and saccharin. These are artificial substances. When the body has to encounter them, or even when they come close to your energy field, they will always make you weaker. This is what diet soda is comprised of. This is what all of the sugar-free this's and that are. And every time you put it into your body, you have weakened yourself. The envelope that I am holding, to which I could not push her arm down, contains pure vitamin C. It's just powdered vitamin C. Okay. Isn't that something? Now, any one of you that doubts what I've just done, or thinks that there might be some kind of trick to this. David Hawkins says in his book that if they really wanted to know whether Bill Clinton had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky, that it's absolutely infallible, that this test. When I ask her to give the truth, I couldn't move her arm. When I ask her to lie, her arm got weak. Her weakest moment in her arms was when she felt shame, whatever that was, whatever you were feeling. She could hardly even hold her arm up. And fear. And I could have gone through the entire list. And what I'm saying here, what I'm suggesting here, what I want you to think about in this little demonstration, and in Hawkins' book, he goes in depth through how to do this, and you can work with this in your own life. This is one of the most fun parlor games that you can have at home. Because my daughters come home when they bring all of their girlfriends over, and did you ever smoke marijuana? And come on, get up here and do it. Come on, and have you ever let anybody touch you? Come on, let's go. And every single time. And if you take sprinkles, and the sugar things that you put it in, when my daughter loves to put those on, and I said, come on, honey, let's just do a little muscle test and see. And she holds them up against there, and she can't hold her arm up even for a second. And when I put the vitamin C or put juice or whatever, she computes strong. Even if you don't know, he even does a test in there where they take two apples, one of which they both look identical. One has been treated by chemicals, by pesticides, and the other one is organically grown. And they hold, you pick whichever one. You don't have any idea. The pesticides on the apple will make you weak, the ones that are. So it's a fascinating look. Now, what does it demonstrate? What's the purpose other than just being a nice parlor game? It demonstrates that there is a connection between the way that we think, the energy of our thoughts, if you will, and the physiological reactions of our body in the world. And that this reaction is independent of your opinion about it. In fact, you don't even have to know what you are thinking when we put certain substances that are not good for you into your energy field. It contaminates it, and it's contaminating it through an energy. These energies, this is a frequency. There is, it's invisible. Of course it's invisible. But nevertheless, it's real, and it impacts every single one of us. And we can go through our life. Now imagine this, that if a thought of shame or a thought of fear or a thought of guilt creates a muscle reaction in which you can't move your arm, imagine what it's doing to your heart, which is a strong muscle, isn't it? If you go around all day with thoughts of shame and guilt and fear and worry, what's happening to your heart? You are weakening your heart. You are literally sending energy that is disempowering you. Whereas if you're thinking thoughts of love and connection and spirit and God, you are strengthening your heart. Imagine your kidneys. Imagine your liver. Imagine the joints in your body. Imagine your eyes. Imagine every single aspect of this thing called your body, and understand that every single thought that you have impacts it in a way that either makes it empowered or disempowered. And so too are all of the substances that we put into our bodies. You take a bottle of scotch and you put it up next to your solar plexus, and you push it into your solar plexus, and you will not hold your arm up even with one finger, because scotch, pure alcohol whiskey, no dog, if you pour scotch on his dog food, will ever have anything to do with it. Now look at him, you must be kidding me. And by the way, that's the same reaction you had the first time you tasted it. Woo! What is this? And you spit it out like it's what? Poison, isn't it? But then, of course, that's just because you're immature. You haven't really learned how to overcome those poisons and make them a part of your daily life, which is what mature people do. This is not for children who know that this is terrible for them. This is for those of us who go out and have cocktails. And every time we have one, we send a signal to the rest of our body that it is going to be weakened. Okay, if everything is energy, and if every thought that we have impacts or empowers us in some way, I've always said that if you understand that what you think about is what expands into the physical world, then after a while, you'll start getting real careful about what you think about. Real careful about what you think about. And when you start having these thoughts, you notice with Allison that when she was thinking shame, how weak she became, and what did it take to send that weakness out of her body in just that instant that she was standing up there with me? What did it take? A thought of what? Of love. A thought of God. A thought of spirit. A thought of kindness. These are all the components, the seven components of spirituality that I spoke about earlier. When you change your thought, when you shift your thought from one of anguish, self-pity, depression, worry, fear, and particularly shame, when you shift that thought in the instant, and when people say, yeah, but how do I do it? I don't know how you do it. You just do it. If I say to you right now, I want you to think of a very unhappy thought. I'd like you to picture a dog that has just been hit by the side of the road, and it's a German Shepherd, and it's brown and black, and it's got blood trickling out of its mouth, and it's lying there on the side of the road. Is there anyone that can't do that? You can see that picture, can't you? Okay, that's a very disempowering picture. So let's change it. Change it and shift it to a bouquet of roses, red roses with that white baby breath or whatever they call it in back of it, and the greens coming behind it, and 12 beautiful long stem roses, each of them going out in a little bit of a different direction. And is there anyone who can't do that? All right, how did you do that? You tell me. You just did it. You just did it. You just do it. And no one can explain how. No one can explain the mechanics behind it. Even the greatest neurosurgeon in the world can't explain the mechanics behind. You just change your thoughts. You train yourself to think in a different way when confronted with and knowing that your thoughts are on anything that is going to disempower you. Or surely the presence of love will correct my perception that I have a problem. You just change it. And of course, you also change what you put into your body. You decontaminate your energy fields. You don't allow yourself to consume foods, substances. And if you want to know whether a substance works or doesn't work for you, even if you want to check your vitamins, or if you want to check anything that you might be taking, just have someone stand in front of you, put your arm out with no watch on it, because a quartz movement will interfere with this. It has energy of its own. And ask them to put their one hand on your right shoulder and their other hand with two fingers, the forefinger and the next finger, and just have them to push down until you resist as strong as you can. And then with your right hand, take your vitamins or take your food, or take your liquor, or take your cocaine, or take whatever it is that you might find yourself addicted to or practicing, and push it into your solar plexus, and then ask that person to push down on your arm. And if your arm goes down with very little resistance, it's disempowering. And if it stays up, it's empowering. Hawkins did a study with 1,000 people, and he put 500 envelopes of aspartame and 500 envelopes of pure vitamin C, and 100% of the time, every single person in the audience, when they paired up, the aspartame computed weak and the vitamin C computed strong. And yet we fill ourselves with this stuff. How much diet soda do we sell in this country? And hold up a can of diet soda to your solar plexus and watch what happens. I've done this with my daughters. Said, look, you can't even resist when I use one finger to push down on your arm. And you hold up a glass of orange juice, pure orange juice, and watch what happens, and I can't budge their arm. There's an energy to everything. Everything has energy. That's the message of what I'm speaking about here. Now what I want to do is I want you to picture, if you're listening on tape, and I want you to observe here, that I'm going to create a line that goes from my left all the way to as far as I can go across this room to my right. At my extreme left, I am going to call this point A. And I'm going to call this the beginning of a continuum. And I'm going to put a frequency number on this, and it isn't anything that is real in the sense of research. It's just a number that I'm using because it makes it much easier to talk about and demonstrate what I want to do here. And I'm going to call this low, slow frequency, as far left as I can go on this continuum, I'm going to call this 10,000 cycles per second. That's the energy. All right. That's the frequency at which this vibrates. Then I'm going to move to the very center of this continuum, right here, if you will, in the center of the room. And I'm going to call this point B. And this point B, I'm going to put a number on. I'm going to call this number 20,000 cycles per second. 20,000 cycles per second. Okay? And over here at my far right, I'm going to put, as far as I can go, right here at the end, I'm going to call this point C. And I'm going to call this 100,000 cycles per second. All right? A very fast energy, a very fast frequency. Okay? You see the picture? A continuum, A, B, C, 10,000 cycles per second, 20,000 cycles per second in the center, and 100,000 cycles per second at my far right. That's the continuum. And I'm going to talk about three things. The first thing I'm going to talk about on this continuum is your physical health. Your physical health. Okay? And at point A on this continuum of your physical health, at 10,000 cycles per second, where I am standing right now at point A to my...